Chapter 19. Government Finance. The willingness of government to levy taxes fell distinctly short of its propensity to spend. Arthur F. Burns. Like individuals, businesses, and other organizations, governments must have resources in order to continue to exist. In centuries past, some governments would take these resources directly in the form of a share of the crops, livestock, or other tangible assets of the population. But in modern industrial and commercial societies, governments take a share of the national output in the form of money. However, these financial transactions have repercussions on the economy that go far beyond money changing hands. Consumers can change what they buy when some of the goods they use are heavily taxed and other goods are not. Businesses can change what they produce when some kinds of output are taxed and others are subsidized. Investors can decide to put their money into tax-free municipal bonds or into some foreign country with lower tax rates when taxes on the earnings from their investments rise, and they can reverse these decisions when tax rates fall. In short, people change their behavior in response to government financial operations. These operations include taxation, the sale of government bonds, and innumerable ways of spending money currently or promising to spend future money, such as by guaranteeing bank deposits or establishing pension systems to cover some or all of the population when they retire. The government of the United States spent nearly $3.5 trillion in 2013. One of the ways of dealing with the many complications of government financial operations is to break them down into the ways that governments raise money and the ways that they spend money, and then examine each separately in terms of the repercussions of these operations on the economy as a whole. In fact, the repercussions extend beyond national boundaries to other countries around the world. Acquiring wealth has long been one of the main preoccupations of governments, whether in the days of the Roman Empire, in the ancient Chinese dynasties, or in modern Europe or America. Today, tax revenues and bond sales are usually the largest sources of money for the national government. The choice between financing government activities with current tax revenues or with revenues from the sale of bonds, in other words, going into debt, has further repercussions on the economy at large. As in many other areas of economics, the facts are relatively straightforward, but the words used to describe the facts can lead to needless complications and misunderstandings. Some of the words used in discussing the financial operations of the government, balanced budget, deficit, surplus, national debt, need to be plainly defined in order to avoid misunderstandings or even hysteria. If all current government spending is paid for with money received in taxes, then the budget is said to be balanced. If current tax receipts exceed current spending, then there is said to be a budget surplus. If tax revenues do not cover all of the government spending, some of which is covered by revenues from the sale of bonds, then the government is said to be operating at a deficit, since bonds are a debt for the government to repay in the future. The accumulation of deficits over time adds up to the government's debt, which is called the national debt. If this term really meant what it said, the national debt would include all the debts in the nation, including those of consumers and businesses. But in practice, the term national debt means simply the debt owed by the national government. Just as the government's revenues come in from many sources, so government spending goes out to pay for many different things. Some spending is for things to be used during the current year, the pay of civilian and military personnel, the cost of electricity, paper, and other supplies required by the vast array of government institutions. Other spending is for things to be used both currently and in the future, such as highways, bridges, and hydroelectric dams. Although government spending is often all lumped together in media and political discussions, the particular kind of spending is often related to the particular way money is raised to pay for it. For example, taxes may be considered an appropriate way for current taxpayers to pay for spending on current benefits provided by government, but issuing government bonds may be considered more appropriate to have future generations help pay for things being created for their future use or benefit, such as the highways, bridges, and dams already mentioned. In the case of city governments, subways and public libraries are built to serve both the current generation and future generations, so the costs of building them are appropriately shared between current and future generations by paying for their construction with both current tax revenues and money raised by selling bonds that will be redeemed with money from future taxpayers. Government revenues. Government revenues come not only from taxes and the sale of bonds, but also from the prices charged for various goods and services that governments provide, as well as from the sale of assets that the government owns, such as land, old office furniture, or surplus military equipment. Charges for various goods and services provided by local, state, or national governments in the United States range from municipal transit fares and fees for using municipal golf courses to charges for entering national parks or for cutting timber on federal land. The prices charged for goods and services sold by the government are seldom what they would be if the same goods or services were sold by businesses in a free market, and therefore government sales seldom have the same effect on the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. In short, these transactions are not simply transfers of money, but, more fundamentally, transfers of tangible resources in ways that affect the efficiency with which the economy operates. During the pioneering era in America, the federal government of the United States sold to the public vast amounts of land that it had acquired in various ways from the indigenous population or from foreign governments, such as those of France, Spain, Mexico, and Russia. In centuries past, governments in Europe and elsewhere often sold monopoly rights to engage in various economic activities, such as selling salt or importing gold. During the late 20th century, many national governments around the world that had taken over various industrial and commercial enterprises began selling them to private investors in order to have a more market-directed economy. Another way for governments to get money to spend is simply to print it, as many governments have done at various periods of history. However, the disastrous consequences of the resulting inflation have made this too risky politically for most governments to rely on this as a common practice. Even when the Federal Reserve System of the United States resorted to the creation of more money as a policy for dealing with a sluggish economy in the early 21st century, the Federal Reserve coined a new term, quantitative easing, that many people would not understand as readily as they would understand a more straightforward term like printing money. Tax rates and tax revenues. Death and taxes have long been regarded as inescapable realities, but which of the various ways in which taxes can be collected is actually used, and which particular tax rate is imposed, makes a difference in the way individuals, enterprises, and the national economy as a whole respond. Depending on those responses, a higher tax rate may or may not lead to higher tax revenues, or a lower tax rate to lower tax revenues. When tax rates are raised 10%, it may be assumed by some that tax revenues will also rise by 10%. But in fact, more people may move out of a heavily taxed jurisdiction or buy less of a heavily taxed commodity, so that the revenues received can be disappointingly far below what was estimated. The revenues may, in some cases, go down after the tax rate goes up. When the state of Maryland passed a higher tax rate on people earning $1 million a year or more, taking effect in 2008, the number of such people living in Maryland fell from nearly 8,000 to fewer than 6,000. Although it had been projected that the additional tax revenue collected from these people in Maryland would rise by $106 million, instead these revenues fell by $257 million. When Oregon raised its income tax rates in 2009, on people earning $250,000 or more, Oregon's income tax revenues likewise fell by $50 billion. Conversely, when the federal tax rate on capital gains was lowered in the United States from 28% to 20% in 1997, it was assumed that revenues from the capital gains tax would fall below the $54 billion collected under the higher rates in 1996, and below the $209 billion that had been projected to be collected over the next 4 years, before the tax rate was cut. Instead, tax revenues from the capital gains tax rose after the capital gains tax rate was cut, and $372 billion were collected in capital gains taxes over the next 4 years, nearly twice what had been projected under the old and higher tax rates. People adjusted their behavior to a more favorable outlook for investments by increasing their investments, so that the new and lower tax rate on the returns from these increased investments amounted to more total revenue for the government than that produced by the previous higher tax rate on a smaller amount of investment. Instead of keeping their money in tax-exempt municipal bonds, for example, investors could now find it more advantageous to invest in producing real goods and services with a higher rate of return, now that lower tax rates enable them to keep more of their gains. Tax-exempt securities usually pay lower rates of return than securities whose returns are subject to taxation. As a hypothetical example, if tax-exempt municipal bonds are paying 3% and taxable corporate bonds are paying 5%, then someone who is in an income bracket that pays 50% in taxes is better off getting the tax-exempt 3% from municipal bonds than to have 2.5% left after half of the 5% return on corporate bonds has been taxed away. But if the top tax rate is cut to 30%, then it pays someone in that same income bracket to buy the corporate bonds instead, because that will leave 3.5% after taxes. Depending on how many people are in that income bracket and how many bonds they buy, the government can end up collecting more tax revenues after cutting the tax rates. None of this should be surprising. Many a business has become more profitable by charging lower prices, thereby increasing sales and earning higher total profits at a lower rate of profit per sale. Taxes are the prices charged by governments, and sometimes the government, too, can collect more total revenue at a lower tax rate. It all depends on how high the tax rates are initially and how people react to an increase or a decrease. There are other times, of course, where a higher tax rate leads to a correspondingly higher amount of tax revenues, and a lower tax rate leads to a lower amount of tax revenues. The failure of tax revenues to automatically move in the same direction as tax rates is not peculiar to the United States. In Iceland, as the corporate tax rate was gradually reduced from 45% to 18% between 1991 and 2001, tax revenues tripled. High-income people in Britain have relocated to avoid impending increases in tax rates, just as people have in Maryland and Oregon. In 2009, for example, the Wall Street Journal reported, "A stream of hedge fund managers and other financial services professionals are quitting the UK, following plans to raise the top personal tax rates to 51%. Lawyers estimate hedge funds managing close to $15 billion have moved to Switzerland in the past year, with more possibly to come." Although it is common in politics and in the media to refer to governments raising taxes or cutting taxes, this terminology blurs the crucial distinction between tax rates and tax revenues. The government can change tax rates, but the reaction of the public to these changes can result in either a higher or a lower amount of tax revenues being collected, depending on circumstances and responses. Thus, references to proposals for a $500 billion tax cut or a $700 billion tax increase are wholly misleading, because all that the government can enact is a change in tax rates, whose actual effects on revenue can be determined only later, after the tax rate changes have gone into effect and the taxpayers respond to the changes. The incidence of taxation. Knowing who is legally required to pay a given tax to the government does not automatically tell us who, in fact, ultimately bears the burden created by that tax, a burden which in some cases can be passed on to others, and in other cases cannot. Who pays how much of the taxes collected by the government? This question cannot be answered simply by looking at tax laws or even at a table of estimates based on those laws. As we have already seen, people may react to tax changes by changing their own behavior, and different people have different abilities to change their behavior in order to avoid taxes. While an investor can invest in tax-free bonds at a lower rate of return or in other assets that pay a higher rate of return but are subject to taxes, a factory worker whose sole income is his paycheck has no such options and finds whatever taxes the government takes already gone by the time he gets that paycheck. Various complex financial arrangements can spare wealthy people from having to pay taxes on all their income, But since these complex arrangements require lawyers, accountants, and other professionals to make such arrangements, people of more modest incomes may not be equally able to escape their tax burden and can even end up paying a higher percentage of their income in taxes than someone who is in a higher income bracket that is officially taxed at a higher rate. Since income is not the only thing that is taxed, how much total tax any given individual pays depends also on how many other taxes apply and what that individual's situation is. Obviously, taxes on homes or automobiles fall only on those who own them, and while sales taxes fall on whoever buys any of the many items subject to those taxes, different people spend different proportions of their income on consumer goods. Lower-income people tend to spend a higher percentage of their income on consumer goods, while higher-income people tend to invest more, sometimes most, of their income. The net effect is that sales taxes tend to take a higher percentage of the incomes of low-income people than they take from the incomes of higher-income people. This is called a regressive tax, as distinguished from a progressive tax that subjects higher incomes to a higher percentage rate of taxation. Social Security taxes are likewise regressive, since they apply only to incomes up to some fixed level, with income above that level not being subject to Social Security taxes. Income taxes, on the other hand, exempt incomes below some fixed level. Given the different rules for different kinds of taxation, figuring out what the total incidence of taxation is for different people is not easy in principle, much less in practice. Issues and controversies about tax rates often discuss the incidence of taxes on the rich or the poor, when in fact the taxes fall on income rather than wealth. A genuinely rich person, someone with enough wealth not to have to work at all, may have a very modest income or no income at all during a given year. Moreover, even during years of high incomes and high rates of taxation on that income, this taxation does not touch the rich individual's accumulated wealth. Most of the people described as rich in discussions of tax issues are in fact not rich at all, but simply people who have reached their peak earnings years, often having worked their way up to that peak after decades of earning much more modest salaries. Progressive income taxes typically hit such people rather than the genuinely rich. Since each individual pays a mixture of progressive and regressive taxes, as well as taxes that apply to some goods and not to others, it is by no means easy to determine who is actually paying what share of the country's taxes. What is even more difficult is to determine who bears the real burden of a given tax by suffering the consequences of changed outcomes. For example, American employers pay half of the taxes that support Social Security and all of the taxes that pay for unemployment compensation. However, as we have seen in Chapter 10, how high an employer is willing to bid for a worker's services is limited by the amount that will be added to the employer's revenue by hiring that worker. But an employee whose output adds $50,000 to a company's sales receipts may not be worth even $45,000 if Social Security taxes, unemployment taxes, and other costs of employment add up to $10,000. In that case, the upper limit to how far an employer would bid for that person's services would be $40,000, not $50,000. Even though the worker does not directly pay any of that $10,000, if the pay received by that worker is $10,000 less than it would be otherwise, then the burden of these taxes has in effect fallen on the worker, no matter who sends the tax money to the government. It is much the same story when taxes are levied on businesses, which then raise their prices to the consumer. Depending on the nature of the tax and the competition in the market, the consumers can end up paying anywhere from none to all of the burden of those taxes. In short, the official legal liability for the direct payment of taxes to the government does not necessarily tell who really bears the economic burden in the end. Taxes cannot be passed on to consumers when a particular tax falls on businesses or products produced in a particular place, if consumers have the option of buying the same product produced in other places not subject to the same tax. As noted in Chapter 6, if the government of South Africa imposes a tax of $10 an ounce on gold, South African gold cannot be sold in the world market for $10 an ounce more than gold produced in other countries where that tax does not apply, since gold is gold as far as consumers are concerned, regardless of where it was produced. The price of gold produced and sold within South Africa could rise by $10 an ounce if the South African government forbade the importation of gold from countries without such a tax. Even in the absence of a ban on the importation of gold, the price of gold could rise somewhat within South Africa if there were transportation costs of, say, $2 an ounce for gold produced in the nearest other gold-producing countries. But in that case, only $2 an ounce of the tax could be passed on to the South African consumers as a price increase, and South African gold producers would have to absorb the other $8 in tax increases themselves, as well as absorbing the entire $10 for gold that they sell outside South Africa. Whatever the product and whatever the tax, where the actual burden of that tax falls in practice depends on many economic factors, not just on who is compelled by law to deliver the money to the government. Inflation can change the incidence of taxation in other ways. Under what is called progressive taxation, people with higher incomes pay not only a higher amount of taxes, but also a higher percentage of their incomes. During periods of substantial inflation, people of modest means find their dollar incomes rising as the cost of living rises, even if on net balance they are unable to purchase any more real goods and services than before. But because tax laws are written in terms of money, citizens with only average levels of income can end up paying a higher percentage of their incomes in taxes when their money incomes rise to levels once reached by affluent or wealthy people. In short, the combination of inflation and progressive income taxation laws means rising tax rates for a given real income, even when the tax laws remain unchanged. Conversely, a period of deflation means falling tax rates on a given real income. Where income is in the form of capital gains, the effect of inflation is accentuated because of the years that can elapse between the time when an investment is made and the time when that investment begins to pay a return, or is expected to pay a return, since expectations are by no means always fulfilled. If an investment of $1 million is made by a business and the price level doubles over the years, that investment will become worth $2 million, even if it has failed to earn anything. Because tax laws are based on value expressed in money, that business will now have to pay taxes on the additional $1 million, even though the real value of the investment has failed to grow in the years since it was made. Whatever the losses sustained by such businesses, the larger and more fundamental question is the effect of inflation on the economy as a whole. Since financial markets make investments, or decline to make investments, on the basis of the anticipated returns, during a period of sustained inflation and substantial tax rates on capital gains, these markets are less willing to make investments at rates of return that would otherwise cause them to invest, because the effective tax rates on real capital gains are higher, and taxes may be collected even when there is no real capital gain at all. Declining levels of investment mean declining economic activity in general and declining job opportunities. According to a business economist, from the late 1960s to the early 1980s, effective tax rates on capital averaged more than 100%. Perhaps it is no coincidence that real equity values, stock prices adjusted for inflation, collapsed by nearly two-thirds from 1968 to 1982. This period saw sputtering productivity, rising inflation, high unemployment, and an American economy in general decline. Local taxation. Taxation, of course, occurs at both the national and the local levels. In the United States, local property taxes supply much of the revenue used by local governments. Like other governmental units, local governments tend to want to maximize the revenues they receive, which in turn enables local officials to maximize the favorable publicity they receive from spending money in ways that will increase their chances of re-election. At the same time, raising tax rates produces adverse political reactions, which can reduce these officials' re-election prospects. Among the ways used by local officials to escape this dilemma has been one also used by national officials: issue bonds to pay for much of current spending, thereby producing immediate benefits to dispense and thereby gain votes, while in effect taxing future taxpayers who will have to pay the bondholders when the bonds reach their maturity dates. Since future taxpayers include many who are too young to vote currently, including some who are yet unborn, current deficit spending maximizes the current political benefits to current officials while minimizing effects from current taxpayers and voters. One of the things that makes deficit spending especially attractive to local politicians is that many municipal and state bonds are tax-exempt. That makes such bonds especially valuable to people with high incomes when the federal taxes on such incomes are very high. Among the repercussions of this are that large sums of money are often available to finance local projects with tax-exempt bonds, regardless of whether these projects would meet any criterion based on weighing costs against benefits. What the high-income purchaser of these bonds is paying for is exemption of income from federal taxation. Unlike purchasers of bonds or stocks in the private economy, the purchaser of tax-exempt local government securities has no vested interest in whether the particular things financed by these securities achieve whatever their object is. Even if these debt-financed expenditures turn out to be a complete failure in achieving whatever they were supposed to achieve, the taxpayers are nevertheless forced to pay the bondholders. From the standpoint of the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses in the economy, the net result is that these politically chosen projects are able to receive more resources than they would in a private free market, including resources that would be more valuable elsewhere. From the standpoint of government revenue, what is gained by the local government is being able to readily sell its bonds that pay a lower interest rate than private securities whose purchasers have to pay taxes on that interest. What is gained financially by the local government may be a fraction of what is lost financially by the federal government that is unable to tax the income on these local bonds. Finally, what is lost by the local taxpayers, albeit in the future, is having to pay higher taxes because of the ease of financing politically chosen projects with tax-exempt bonds. Another way of raising local tax revenues without raising local tax rates is to replace low-valued property with higher-valued property, since the latter yields more tax revenue at a given tax rate. This replacement can be achieved by condemning as blighted the housing and businesses in low-income or even moderate-income neighborhoods, acquiring the property through the power of eminent domain, and then transferring it to other private enterprises that will build upscale shopping malls, hotels, or casinos, for example, which will generate more tax revenue than the existing homeowners and business owners were paying. The outraged homeowners and business owners, who often receive less in compensation than the market value of their demolished property, are usually a sufficiently small percentage of the voting population that local officials can gain votes on net balance, if they calculate accurately. It is often possible to convince others in the media and in the public that it is these dispossessed tenants, homeowners, and business owners who are selfish in opposing progress for the whole community. This apparent progress can be illustrated with pictures taken before and after local redevelopment, showing newer and more upscale neighborhoods replacing the old. But much of this local progress may be part of a zero-sum process nationally, when things that would have been built in one place are built in another place, because confiscated property costs less to the new owners than it would have cost elsewhere in a free market. But the new owner's financial gain is the original owner's financial loss. Even if the original owners were compensated at the full market value of their properties, this may still be less than the property was worth to them, since they obviously had not sold their property before it was taken from them through the power of eminent domain. In this case, there is not simply a zero-sum process, but a negative-sum process, in which what is gained by some is exceeded by what is lost by others. The 2005 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Kelo v. New London expanded the powers of governments to take property under the powers of eminent domain for public purposes, extending beyond the Constitution's authorization of taking private property for public use, such as building reservoirs, bridges, or highways. This decision confirmed the power already being exercised to transfer private property from one user to another, even if the latter were simply building amusement parks or other recreational facilities. What this means economically, in terms of the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses, is that the alternative uses no longer have to be of higher value than the original uses, since the alternative users no longer have to bid the property away from the original owners. Instead, those who want the property can rely on government officials to simply take it, exercising the power of eminent domain, and then sell it to them for less than they would have had to pay the existing property owners to get the latter to transfer the property to them voluntarily. Government bonds. Selling government bonds is simply borrowing money to be repaid from future tax revenues. Government bonds can also be a source of confusion under their other name, the national debt. These bonds, like all bonds, are indeed a debt, but the economic significance of a given amount of debt can vary greatly according to the circumstances. That is as true for the government as it is for an individual. What would be a huge debt for a factory worker may be insignificant for a millionaire who can easily pay it off at his convenience. Similarly, a national debt that would be crushing when a nation's income is low may be quite manageable when national income is much higher. Thus, although the U.S. national debt held by the public reached a record high in 2004, it was only 37% of the country's gross domestic product at that time, while a much smaller debt, decades earlier, was a higher percentage of the GDP back in 1945, when the U.S. national debt was more than 100% of the GDP that year. Like other statistical aggregates, the national debt tends to grow over time as population and the national income grow, and as inflation causes a given number of dollars to represent smaller amounts of real wealth or real liabilities. This presents political opportunities for critics of whatever party is in power to denounce their running up record-breaking debts to be paid by future generations. Depending on the specific circumstances of a particular country at a particular time, this may be a reason for serious concern, or the criticisms may be simply political theater. National debts must be compared not only to national output or national income, but also to the alternatives facing a given nation at a given time. For example, the federal debt of the United States in 1945 was $258 billion, at a time when the national income was $182 billion. In other words, the national debt was 41% higher than the national income as a result of paying the enormous costs of fighting World War II. The costs of not fighting the Nazis or Imperial Japan were considered to be so much worse that the national debt seemed secondary at the time. Even in peacetime, if a nation's highways and bridges are crumbling from a lack of maintenance and repair, that does not appear in national debt statistics, but neglected infrastructure is a burden being passed on to the next generation, just as surely as a national debt would be. If the costs of repairs are worth the benefits, then issuing government bonds to raise the money needed to restore this infrastructure makes sense, and the burden on future generations may be no greater than if the bonds had never been issued, though it takes the form of money owed rather than the form of crumbling and perhaps dangerous infrastructure that may become even more costly to repair in the next generation due to continued neglect. Either wartime or peacetime expenditures by the government can be paid for out of tax revenues or out of money received from selling government bonds. Which method makes more economic sense depends in part on whether the money is being spent for a current flow of goods and services, such as electricity or paper for government agencies or food for the military forces, or is instead being spent for adding to an accumulated stock of capital, such as hydroelectric dams or national highways, to be used in future years for future generations. Going into debt to create long-term investments makes as much sense for the government as a private individual's borrowing more than his annual income to buy a house. By the same token, people who borrow more than their annual income to pay for lavish entertainment this year are simply living beyond their means and probably heading for big financial trouble. The same principle applies to government expenditures for current benefits, with the costs being passed on to future generations. What must also be taken into account when assessing a national debt is to whom it is owed. When a government sells all of its bonds to its own citizens, that is very different from selling all or a substantial part of its bonds to people in other countries. The difference is that an internal debt is held by the same population that is responsible for paying the taxes to redeem the principal and pay the interest. We owe it to ourselves, is a phrase sometimes used to describe this situation. But when a significant share of the bonds issued by the U.S. government is bought by people in China or Japan, then the bondholders and the taxpayers are no longer the same population. Future generations of Chinese and Japanese will be able to collect wealth from future generations of Americans. As of 2011, nearly half the federal debt of the United States, 46%, was held by foreigners. Even when a national debt is held entirely by citizens of the country that issued the bonds, different individuals hold different shares of the bonds and pay different shares of the taxes. Much also depends on how members of future generations acquire the bonds issued to the current generation. If the next generation simply inherits the bonds bought by the current generation, then they inherit both the debt and the wealth required to pay off the debt, so that there is no net burden passed on from one generation to the next. If, however, the older generation sells its bonds to the younger generation, either directly from individual to individual, or by cashing in the bonds, which the government pays for by issuing new bonds to new people, then the burden of the debt may be liquidated, as far as the older generation is concerned, and passed on to the next generation. Financial arrangements and their complications should not obscure what is happening in terms of real goods and services. When the United States fought World War II, running up a huge national debt did not mean that the Americans alive at that time got something for nothing on credit. The tanks, bombers, and other military equipment and supplies used to fight the war came out of the American economy at that time, at the expense of consumer goods that would otherwise have been produced by American industry. These costs were not paid for by borrowing from people in other countries. American consumers simply consumed a smaller share of American output. Financially, the war was paid for by a mixture of raising taxes and selling bonds. But whatever the particular mixture, that did not relieve that generation from having to sacrifice their standard of living to fight the war. The burden of paying for World War II could be passed on to a later generation only in the sense that the World War II generation could in later years be reimbursed for their sacrifice by the sale of the bonds they had bought during the war. In reality, however, wartime inflation meant that the real purchasing power of the bonds when they were cashed in was not as much as the purchasing power that had been sacrificed to buy the bonds during the war. The World War II generation was permanently stuck with the losses this entailed. In general, the government's choice of acquiring money through the collection of taxes or the sale of government bonds does not relieve the current population of its economic burden unless the government sells the bonds to foreigners. Even in that case, however, this merely postpones the burden. The choice may be more significant politically to the government itself, as it may encounter less resistance when it does not raise taxes to cover all current spending, but relies on bond sales to supplement its tax revenues. This convenience for the government is a temptation to use bond sales to cover current expenses instead of reserving such sales to cover spending on long-term projects. There are obvious political benefits available to those currently in power by spending money to provide benefits to current voters and passing the costs on to those currently too young to vote, including those who are not yet born. Although government bonds get paid off when they reach their maturity dates, usually new bonds are issued and sold so that the national debt is turned over rather than being paid off, though at particular periods of history some countries have paid off their national debts, either partially or completely. This does not mean that selling government bonds is without costs or risks. The cost to the government includes the interest that must be paid on the national debt. The more important cost to the economy is the government's absorption of investment funds that could otherwise have gone into the private sector, where they would have added to the country's capital equipment. When the national debt reaches a size where investors begin to worry about whether it can continue to be turned over as government bonds mature, without raising interest rates to attract the needed buyers, that can lead to expectations that higher interest rates will inhibit future investment, an expectation that can immediately inhibit current investment. Rising interest rates for government bonds tend to affect other interest rates, which also rise due to competition for investment funds in the financial markets, and that in turn tends to reduce credit and the aggregate demand on which continuing prosperity depends. How serious such dangers are depends on the size of the national debt, not absolutely, but relative to the nation's income. Professional financiers and investors know this, and so are unlikely to panic even when there is a record-breaking national debt, if that is not a large debt relative to the size of the economy. That is why, despite much political rhetoric about the American government's budget deficit and the growing national debt it created in the early 21st century, distinguished economist Michael Boskin could say in 2004, "Wall Street yawned when the deficit projections soared." The financiers were vindicated when the size of the deficit in 2005 declined below what it had been in 2004. The New York Times reported, "The big surprise has been in tax revenue, which is running nearly 15% higher than in 2004. Corporate tax revenue has soared about 40% after languishing for 4 years, and individual tax revenue is up as well." Surprise is in the eye of the beholder. There was nothing unprecedented about rising tax revenues without an increase in tax rates. Indeed, there have been at various times and places increases in tax revenues following a cut in tax rates. While the absolute size of the national debt may overstate the economic risks to the economy under some conditions, it may also understate the risks under other circumstances. Where the government has large financial liabilities looming on the horizon, but not yet part of the official budget, then the official national debt may be considerably less than what the government owes. After the financial crises in the housing industry in early 21st century America, for example, the Federal Housing Administration had far less money on hand than they were supposed to have, in proportion to the mortgages that they had guaranteed. As more mortgages defaulted, it was only a matter of time before the Federal Housing Administration would have to turn to the Treasury Department for more money. But any such transfer of money from the Treasury would add to the official annual deficit, and thus to the national debt, which could be a political embarrassment before an election. Thus, although the Wall Street Journal reported in 2009 that the Federal Housing Administration's capital reserves have fallen to razor-thin levels, increasing the likelihood the agency will eventually require a taxpayer bailout, that bailout did not come until 2013, the year after the 2012 elections. When the Treasury Department supplied the FHA with $1.7 billion, only then did the government's financial liability enter the official annual federal deficit and become part of the national debt. Yet it would be politically impossible for any administration to let the FHA default on its mortgage guarantees, so this financial liability was always just as real as anything that was included in the official national debt, even before the Treasury bailout actually occurred. As the national debt of the United States rose in 2013 to nearly $17 trillion, just over 100% of gross domestic product, Wall Street was no longer yawning, as Professor Boskin put it 9 years earlier. It is one thing to have a national debt as large as the gross domestic product, or larger, at the end of a major war, for the return of peace means drastic reductions in military spending, which presents an opportunity to begin paying down that national debt over the ensuing years. But to have a comparable national debt in peacetime presents more grim options, because there is no indication of the kind of reduction of government spending which occurs at the end of a war. Charges for goods and services. As already noted, both local and national governments charge for providing various goods and services. These charges are often quite different from what they would be in a free market, because the incentives facing officials who set these charges are different. Therefore, the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses is also different. Mass transportation in cities was once provided by private businesses, which charged fares that covered both current expenses, fuel, the pay of bus drivers, etc., and the longer-run costs of buying new buses, trolleys, or subway trains to replace those that wore out, as well as paying a rate of return on the capital provided by investors sufficient to keep investors supplying this capital. Over the years, however, many privately owned municipal transit systems became government-owned. Often this was because the fares were regulated by municipal authorities and were not allowed to rise enough to continue to maintain the transit system, especially during periods of inflation. In New York City, for example, the 5-cent subway fare remained politically sacred for years, even during periods of high inflation when all other prices were rising, including the prices paid for the equipment, supplies, and labor used to keep the subways running. Clearly, privately owned subway systems were no longer viable under these money-losing conditions, so the ownership of these systems passed to the city government. While municipal transit was still losing money, the losses were now being made up out of tax revenues. Incentives to stop the losses, which would have been imperative in a privately owned business faced with financial extinction, were now much weaker, if not non-existent, in a municipally owned transit system whose losses were automatically covered by tax revenues. Thus, a service could continue to be provided at costs exceeding the benefits for which passengers were willing to pay. Put differently, resources whose value to people elsewhere in the economy was greater were nevertheless being allocated to municipal transit because of subsidies extracted from taxpayers. Incentives to price government-provided goods and services at lower levels than in a private business are by no means confined to municipal transit. Since lower prices mean more demanded than at higher prices, those who set prices for government-provided goods and services have incentives to assure a sufficient continuing demand for the goods and services they sell, and therefore continuing jobs for themselves. Moreover, since lower prices are less likely to provoke political protests and pressures than are higher prices, the jobs of those controlling the sales of government-provided goods and services are easier, as well as more secure and less stressful when prices are kept below the level that would prevail in a free market, where costs must be covered by sales revenues. In situations where the money paid by those people who are using the goods and services goes into the general treasury, rather than into the coffers of the particular government agency which is providing these goods and services, there is even less incentive to make the charges cover the costs of providing the goods and services. For example, the fees collected for entering Yosemite, Yellowstone, or other national parks go into the U.S. government's treasury, and the costs of maintaining these parks are paid from the treasury, which is to say, from general tax revenues. There is therefore no incentive for officials who run national parks to charge fees that will cover the costs of running those parks. Even where a national park is considered to be overcrowded and its facilities deteriorating from heavy use, there is still no incentive to raise the entry fees, when what matters is how much money Congress will authorize to be paid out of general tax revenues. In short, the normal function provided by prices of causing consumers to ration themselves and producers to keep costs below what consumers are willing to pay is non-existent in these situations. The independence of prices from costs offers political opportunities for elected or appointed officials to cater to particular special interests by offering lower prices to the elderly, for example. Thus, senior citizens are charged a one-time $10 fee for a pass that entitles the holders to enter any national park free for the rest of their lives, while others may be charged $25 each time they enter any national park. The fact that the elderly usually have greater net worth than the general population may carry less weight politically than the fact that the elderly are more likely to vote. Although there are many contexts in which government-provided goods and services are priced below cost, there are other contexts in which these services are priced well above their costs. Bridges, for example, are often built with the idea that the tolls collected from bridge users over the years will eventually cover the cost of building it. However, it is not uncommon for the tolls to continue to be collected long after the original cost has been covered several times over, and when the tolls necessary to cover maintenance and repairs are a fraction of the money that continues to be charged to cross the bridge. Where the particular government agency in charge of a bridge is allowed to keep the tolls it collects, there is every incentive to use that money to undertake other projects, that is, to expand the bureaucratic empire controlled by those in charge of the agency. The bridge authority may decide, for example, to initiate or subsidize ferry service across the same waterway spanned by the bridge in order to meet an unmet need of commuters. As already noted in the first chapter, there are always unmet needs in any economy, and, at a sufficiently low fare on the ferries, there will be people using those ferries, politically demonstrating that need, even if what they pay does not come close to covering the cost of the ferry service. In short, resources will be allocated to the ferry that would never be allocated there if both the bridge and the ferry were independent operations in a free market, and therefore each had to cover its costs from the prices charged. More important, ferries can be allocated resources whose value is greater in alternative uses. In California, for example, the 2 million ferry rides annually from San Francisco to Sausalito and to Larkspur are subsidized by about $15 per ride, or about $30 million total. On the ferry service from South San Francisco to Oakland and Alameda that began in 2012, the average fare charged per round trip was set at $14, with the subsidy from taxpayers and toll payers combined being $94 per round trip. No doubt this new ferry provides a service that benefits the riders, but the relevant question economically is whether these benefits cover the costs. $108 per round trip in this case, of which only $14 is paid by the riders. The only way to determine whether the benefits are really worth the cost of $108 per round trip is to charge $108 per round trip. But there are no incentives for the officials who run the ferry service to do that, when subsidies are readily available from taxpayers and bridge users. Sometimes taxpayer-provided subsidies for some government-provided goods and services are said to be justified because otherwise the poor would be unable to obtain these goods and services. Putting aside for the moment the question whether most of the poor are a permanent class or simply people transiently in low-income brackets, including young people living with middle-class or affluent parents, and even accepting for the sake of argument that it is somehow imperative that the poor use the particular goods and services in question, subsidizing everybody who uses those goods and services in order to help a fraction of the population seems less efficient than directly helping the poor with money or vouchers and letting the others pay their own way. The same principle applies when considering cross-subsidies provided, not by the taxpayers, but by excessive charges on some people, such as toll bridge users, to subsidize others, such as ferry boat riders. The weakness of the rationale based on subsidizing the poor is shown also by how often taxpayer subsidies are used to finance things seldom used by the poor, such as municipal golf courses or symphony orchestras. In general, government charges for goods and services are not simply a matter of transferring money, but of redirecting resources in the economy, usually without much concern for the allocation of those resources in ways that maximize net benefits to the population at large. Government expenditures. The government spends both voluntarily and involuntarily. Officials may voluntarily decide to create a new program or department, or to increase or decrease their appropriations. Alternatively, the government may be forced by pre-existing laws to pay unemployment insurance when a downturn in the economy causes more people to lose their jobs. Government spending may also go up automatically when farmers produce such a bumper crop that it cannot all be sold at the prices guaranteed under agricultural subsidy laws, and so the government is legally obligated to buy the surplus. Unemployment compensation and agricultural subsidies are just two of a whole spectrum of entitlement programs whose spending is beyond the control of any given administration once these programs have been enacted into law. Only repeal of existing entitlement legislation can stop the spending, and that means offending all the existing beneficiaries of such legislation, who may be more numerous than those whose support made that legislation possible in the first place. In short, although government spending and the annual deficits and accumulated national debts, which often result from that spending, are often blamed on those officials who happen to be in charge of the government at a given time, much of the spending is not at their discretion, but is mandated by pre-existing laws. In the U.S. budget for fiscal year 2008, for example, even the military budget for a country currently at war was exceeded by non-discretionary spending on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Government spending has repercussions on the economy, just as taxation does, and both the spending going out and the tax revenues coming in are to some extent beyond the existing administration's control. When production and employment go down in the economy, the tax revenues collected from businesses and workers tend to go down as well. Meanwhile, unemployment compensation, farm subsidies, and other outlays tend to go up. This means that the government is spending more money while receiving less. Therefore, on net balance, government is adding purchasing power to the economy during a downturn, which tends to cushion the decline in output and employment. Conversely, when production and employment are booming, more tax revenues come in and there are fewer individuals or enterprises receiving government financial help, so the government tends to be removing purchasing power from the economy at a time when there might otherwise be inflation. These institutional arrangements are sometimes called automatic stabilizers, since they counter upward or downward movements in the economy without requiring any given administration to make any decisions. Sometimes more is claimed for government spending than the reality will support. Many government programs, whether at local or national levels, are often promoted by saying that, in addition to whatever other benefits are claimed, the money will be spent and re-spent, creating some multiple of the wealth represented by the initial expenditure. In reality, any money, government or private, that is spent will be re-spent again and again. Insofar as the government takes money from one place, from taxpayers or from those who buy government bonds, and transfers it somewhere else, the loss of purchasing power in one place offsets the gain in purchasing power elsewhere. Only if, for some reason, the government is more likely to spend the money than those from whom it was taken, is there a net increase in spending for the country as a whole. John Maynard Keynes' historic contribution to economics was to spell out the conditions under which this was considered likely, but Keynesian economics has been controversial on this and other grounds. The Keynesian policy prescription for getting an economy out of a recession or depression is for the government to spend more money than it receives in tax revenue. This deficit spending adds to the aggregate monetary demand in the economy, according to Keynesian economists, leading to more purchases of goods and services, thereby requiring more hiring of workers and thus reducing unemployment. Dissenters and critics of Keynesian policies have argued that markets can restore employment better through the normal adjustment processes than government intervention can. But neither Keynesian economists nor economists of the rival Chicago school, represented by Milton Friedman, have advocated the kind of ad hoc government interventions in markets actually followed by both the Republican administration of Herbert Hoover and the Democratic administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Costs versus expenditures. When discussing government policies or programs, the cost of those policies or programs is often spoken of without specifying whether that means the cost to the government or the cost to the economy. For example, the cost to the government of forbidding homes or businesses to be built in certain areas is only the cost of running the agencies in charge of controlling such things, which can be a very modest cost, especially after knowledge of the law or policy becomes widespread and few people would consider incurring legal penalties for trying to build in the forbidden areas. But although such a ban on building may cost the government very little, it can cost the economy many billions of dollars by forbidding the creation of valuable assets. Conversely, it may cost the government large sums of money to build and maintain levees along the banks of a river. But if the government did not spend this money, the people could suffer even bigger losses from floods. When the cost of any given policy is considered, it is important to be very clear as to whose costs are being discussed or considered. The cost to the government or the cost to the economy. One of the objections in building more prisons to lock up more criminals for longer periods of time is that it costs the government a large amount of money per criminal per year to keep them behind bars. Sometimes a comparison is made between the cost of keeping a criminal in prison versus the cost of sending someone to college for the same period of time. However, the relevant alternative to the costs of incarceration is the costs sustained by the public when career criminals are outside of prison. In early 21st century Britain, for example, the financial costs of crime have been estimated at £60 billion, while the total costs of prisons were less than £3 billion. Government officials are, of course, preoccupied with the prison costs that they have to cover, rather than the £60 billion that others must pay. In the United States, it has been estimated that the cost of keeping a career criminal behind bars is at least $10,000 a year less than the cost of having him at large. Another area where government expenditures are a grossly misleading indicator of the costs to the country are land acquisition costs under either redevelopment programs or open space policies. When local government officials merely begin discussing publicly the prospect of redeveloping a particular neighborhood by tearing down existing homes and businesses there under the power of eminent domain, that alone is enough to discourage potential buyers of homes or businesses in that neighborhood, so that the present values of those homes and businesses begin declining long before any concrete action is taken by the government. By the time the government acts, which may be years later, the values of properties in the affected neighborhood may be far lower than before the redevelopment plan was discussed. Therefore, even if the property owners are paid just compensation, as required by law, what they are compensated for is the reduced value of their property, not its value before government officials began discussing plans to redevelop the area. Therefore, government compensation expenditures may be far less than the actual costs to the society of losing these particular resources. It is much the same principle when land use restrictions in the name of open space or smart growth reduce the value of land because home builders and others are now prevented from using the land and no longer bid for it. The owners of that land now have few, if any, potential buyers, besides some local government agency or some nonprofit group that wants the land kept as open space. In either case, the money spent to acquire this land can completely understate the cost to the society of no longer having this resource available for alternative uses. As elsewhere, the real costs of any resources, under any economic policy or system, are the alternative uses of those resources. The prices at which the artificially devalued land is transferred completely understate the value of its alternative uses in a free market. Benefits versus net benefits. The weighing of costs against benefits, which is part of the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses, can be greatly affected by government expenditures. While there are some goods and services which virtually everyone considers desirable, different people may consider them desirable to different degrees and are correspondingly willing to pay for them to different degrees. If some product X costs $10, but the average person is willing to pay only $6 for it, then that product will obviously be purchased by only a minority, even if the vast majority regard product X as desirable to some extent. Such situations provide political opportunities to those holding or seeking to be elected to government offices. What is a common situation from an economic standpoint can be redefined politically as a problem, namely that most people want something that costs more than they feel like paying for it. The proposed solution to this problem is often that the government should, in one way or another, make this widely desired product more affordable to more people. Price control is likely to reduce the supply, so the more viable options are government subsidies for the production of the desired product or government subsidies for its purchase. In either case, the public now pays for the product through both the prices paid directly by the purchasers and the taxes paid by the population at large. For the price of this particular $10 product to become affordable, that is, to cost what most people are willing to pay, that price can be no higher than $6. Therefore, a government subsidy of at least $4 must make up the difference, and taxes or bond sales must provide that additional money. The net result, under these conditions, is that millions of people will be paying $10, counting both taxes and the price of the commodity, for something that is worth only $6 to them. In short, government finance in such cases creates a misallocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. A more realistic scenario would be that the costs of running the government program must be added to the costs of production, so that the total cost of the product would rise above the initial $10, making the misallocation of resources greater. Moreover, it is unlikely that the price would be reduced only to that level which the average person was willing to pay, since that would still leave half the population unable to buy the product at a price that they are willing to pay. A more politically likely scenario would be that the price would be reduced below $6 and the cost rise above $10. Many government expenditure patterns that would be hard to explain in terms of the costs and benefits to the public are by no means irrational in terms of the incentives and constraints facing elected officials responsible for these patterns. It is, for example, not uncommon to find governments spending money on building a sports stadium or a community center at a time when the maintenance of roads, highways, and bridges is neglected. The cost of damage done to all the cars using roads with potholes may greatly exceed the cost of repairing the potholes, which in turn may be a fraction of the cost of building a shiny new community center or an impressive sports stadium. Such an expenditure pattern is irrational only if government is conceived of as the public interest personified, rather than as an organization run by elected officials who put their own interests first, as people do in many other institutions and activities. The top priority of an elected official is usually to get re-elected, and that requires a steady stream of favorable publicity to keep the official's name before the public in a good light. The opening of any major new facility, whether urgently needed or not, creates such political opportunities by attracting the media to ribbon-cutting ceremonies, for example. Filling potholes, repairing bridges, or updating the equipment at a sewage treatment plant creates no ribbon-cutting ceremonies or occasions for speeches by politicians. The pattern of government expenditures growing out of such incentives and constraints is not new or limited to particular countries. Adam Smith pointed out a similar pattern back in 18th-century France. The proud minister of an ostentatious court may frequently take pleasure in executing a work of splendor and magnificence, such as a great highway, which is frequently seen by the principal nobility, whose applauses not only flatter his vanity, but even contribute to support his interest at court. But to execute a great number of little works, in which nothing that can be done can make any great appearance, or excite the smallest degree of admiration in any traveler, and which, in short, have nothing to recommend them but their extreme utility, is a business which appears in every respect too mean and paltry to merit the attention of so great a magistrate. Government budgets. Government budgets, including both taxes and expenditures, are not records of what has already happened. They are plans or predictions about what is going to happen. But of course, no one really knows what is going to happen, so everything depends on how projections about the future are made. In the United States, the Congressional Budget Office projects tax receipts without fully taking into account how tax rates tend to change economic behavior, and how changed economic behavior then changes tax receipts. For example, the Congressional Budget Office advised Congress that raising the capital gains tax rate from 20% to 28% in 1986 would increase the revenue received from that tax. But in fact, the revenues from this tax fell after the tax rate was raised. Conversely, cuts in the capital gains tax rate in 1978, 1997, and 2003 all led to increased revenues from that tax. Undaunted, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that an extension of a temporary reduction in the capital gains tax to 15% would cost the Treasury $20 billion in lost revenues, even though this temporary tax cut had already resulted in tens of billions of dollars in increased revenues. From 2003 through 2007, the disparities between the Congressional Budget Office's estimates of tax receipts were off by growing amounts, underestimating tax receipts by $13 billion in 2003 and by $147 billion in 2007. Many in the media reason the same way the Congressional Budget Office reasons, and are caught by surprise when tax revenues do not follow those beliefs. An unexpectedly steep rise in tax revenues from corporations and the wealthy is driving down the projected budget deficit this year, the New York Times reported in 2006. A year later, the deficit had fallen some more and was now just over 1% of the gross domestic product. Moreover, a growing proportion of all the federal tax revenues came from the highest income earners, despite widespread use of the phrase tax cuts for the rich. Back in 1980, when the highest marginal tax rate was 70% on the top income earners, before the series of tax cuts that began in the Reagan administration, 37% of all income tax revenues came from the top 5% of income earners. After a series of tax cuts for the rich over the years had reduced the highest marginal tax rate to 35% by 2004, now more than half of all income tax revenues came from the top 5%. Nevertheless, the phrase tax cuts for the rich has continued to flourish in politics and in the media. As Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, catchwords can delay further analysis for 50 years. When it comes to tax policy, such catchwords have delayed analysis even longer. Neither the Congressional Budget Office nor anyone else can predict with certainty the consequences of a given tax rate increase or decrease. It is not just that the exact amount of revenue cannot be predicted. Whether revenue will move in one direction or in the opposite direction is not a foregone conclusion. The choice is among alternative educated guesses, or, what is worse, mechanically calculating how much revenue will come in if no one's behavior changes in the wake of a tax change. Behavior has changed too often and too dramatically to proceed on that assumption. As far back as 1933, John Maynard Keynes observed that taxation may be so high as to defeat its object, and that, given sufficient time to gather the fruits, a reduction of taxation will run a better chance than an increase of balancing the budget. Since budgets are not records of what has already happened, but projections of what is supposed to happen in the future, everything depends on what assumptions are made and by whom. While the Congressional Budget Office issues projections of what future costs and payments are expected to be, the assumptions from which they derive these projections are provided by Congress. If Congress assumes an unrealistically high rate of economic growth, and therefore a far higher intake of tax revenues, the Congressional Budget Office is required to make its projections of future budget deficits or surpluses based on Congress's assumptions, whether those assumptions are realistic or unrealistic. The media or the public may treat the Congressional Budget Office's estimates as the product of a nonpartisan group of economists and statisticians, but the assumptions provided by politicians are what ultimately determines the end results. A similar situation exists at the state level. Whether the assumptions provided by politicians are about growth rates, rates of return on the government's investments, or any of the many other factors that go into making estimates of the government's finances. When the state of Florida estimated in 2011 how far the money it had set aside to pay its employees' pensions fell short of what was needed to pay those pensions, it proceeded on the arbitrary assumption that it would receive an annual rate of return of 7.75% on the investments it made with that money. But if in fact it turned out to receive only 7%, this difference of less than one percentage point would translate into being nearly $14 billion deeper in debt. If Florida received only a 5% rate of return on its investment of the money set aside to pay these pensions, that would produce a shortfall nearly five times what the state officially estimated, based on a 7.75% rate of return. Because Florida had in fact received only a 2.6% rate of return on this investment in the previous 10 years, these comparisons show the enormous potential for deception when preparing government budgets, simply by changing the arbitrary assumptions on which those budget projections are based. Florida was not unique. As the British magazine The Economist put it, nearly all states apply an optimistic discount rate to their obligations, making the liabilities seem smaller than they are. Among the reasons, governors and mayors have long offered fat pensions to public servants, thus buying votes today and sending the bill to future taxpayers.